floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett. Yes, you are listening to another fine edition of Walking the Floor, and this is a public service announcement. I want to let you know that my upcoming gig, opening for Cadillac 3 at the Troubadour on November 2nd, that is this coming Saturday night, November 2nd, is almost sold out. I got a ticket count like 2 or 3 days ago from my booking agent, and I was told that at that time, there were literally 17 tickets left. So if you haven't got your tickets for the Cadillac 3 show at the Troubadour next Saturday night, get them today. Or you're going to be left out on the curb with all the other people that didn't bother to get online and get their ticket. So go get your ticket right now. Come on. Okay, I'm just sitting here in my house drinking coffee, recovering from a wacky night last night because Foo Fighters played a Children's Cancer Trust fundraiser. Actually, just kind of down the street from where I live, which is weird. Definitely the closest gig we've ever done in proximity to my household. But it was nuts. There was Kenny Loggins, Pink, and The Who were the other acts on the bill. So let me make that clear. We opened for The Who. I didn't actually meet any of them, but I did manage to steal one of Pete Townsend's picks. I got that sitting right here looking good. Other than that, I've just been surfing a ton, kind of settling back into civilian life. It's been nice. Feels good to be home for a stretch. I interviewed pro surfer turned rider Jamie Brizick a few days ago. I'll post that soon. If you haven't picked up his latest book, Dazzling Blue, go to birdwell.com and get it today. He writes like a blog over there. The book is a collection of his blog posts, and it's really good. It's a fun read, quick read, little short two-page, three-page stories about all kinds of stuff, kind of mostly related to the beautiful, dazzling blue ocean that we worship. Get it today. Birdwell.com, Jamie Brizick. I also interviewed a cool Irish singer named Foy Vance just yesterday morning, and that was fantastic. He's really good. If you haven't listened to his music, check that out. I'll be posting that one soon, too. But in the meantime, let's pay some bills with our good friends at Zounds.com. You know Zounds.com, but do you know that Zounds has been around since 1996? If not, you should know. It all started way back when as a small little retail shop and has since grown to become one of the biggest and most badass online musical instrument retailers on the whole planet, on the whole web, the deep dark web, Zounds.com. Their entire staff are musicians. I know this from personal experience. I speak music with them all the time. I speak gig. They speak the language of gig. So if you'd rather call than use the website, you can do that too. Zounds.com. Check it out. Get your stuff. It's good. All right, let's get on over to the interview. Okay, so Randy Houser literally came straight from tour, stopped off at his house for like 5 seconds, I think, and took a shower, and came right over to my hotel room to do this interview. And we did what all married dads do. We talked about missing home and missing our kids and touring life and family and the mystery of what drives us to do what we do. We also go deep into the changes he made in his approach to his latest record, Magnolia, which is, if you haven't listened to it, go listen to it right now. It's fantastic. And how he felt like he was singing karaoke when he was out on tour prior to that. And he gives like what I would sort of characterize as a polite critique of the business side of mainstream Nashville country music. And he also talked a lot about the community of songwriters he came out of before he had really like found his footing as a solo artist. And I got him to tell the whole tale of how Honky Tonk Badonkadonk came to be written. And it's a good story, so stay tuned for that. This is Randy Houser on Walking the Floor.
No turning stone. How you been, man?
I've been good, man. Last time I saw you was at what do you call it? At South by Southwest, weren't you at?
You were at Ray's thing.
Yes,
Ray
that's
Benson's
where I was. Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, that was a good night.
I think I lived about a year out there that week.
Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah,
it was good though. Yeah. It was a good time.
Yeah, those kind of things and this kind of, like, are you doing stuff around Americana Fest right now?
Just a few things. I mean, I'm just going to go play with Paul tonight.
Okay.
Whatever, you know.
These kind of weeks, you know, this crazy South by South, they're just nuts, you know.
We're
a lot of running around.
Touring a lot right now, so I was in Ohio last night, and
so you literally just got home, like, right now?
Yeah.
No shit.
We just, we did a festival up there. Last night,
right?
And we just rolled in, and I've got a 3 month old baby at home, so yeah. I grabbed my shit, grabbed guitars, went to the house, took a shower, and rolled over here.
Dude, thanks for coming, man.
I
don't think my wife would have let me walk out of the house.
Oh, she's cool.
If it was the same way.
No, she's so cool, man. She knows what I do and doesn't give me shit about it.
You know, it's funny, man. I was out for a couple weeks with Foos at the end of summer, and then I was home for a few days, and then I left this runs about 2 weeks all in all.
Yeah.
So about halfway through this run of dates, because I just did a week and a half of shows leading up to this.
Yeah.
And my wife was like, I was called home one morning, she's like, you've been gone for like a fucking month. I know, I'm sorry.
I know, Tatiana gets it too, man. It's just, you know, it's tough. I mean, and I keep up with you on your social media and all that to see where all your head. I mean, you're a busy man.
Well, you're a busy man. I was going to actually ask you about that, but I was looking at your tour dates.
Yeah.
You tour like a motherfucker. You're
busy as I can, you know, but I just love what I do, man.
Right.
I love being out, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I've been, you know, like a lot of other guys, I've been doing this so long, it's like, that's honestly where I'm most comfortable, you know, and where I'm most, you know, I'm hard to say sometimes, but I'm almost most at home out somewhere else, just like what you're used to.
I find when I get home, I spend the whole time I'm away going, when I get home, I'm going to take care of this and I'm going to take care of that. And then I get home, I'm like, now what?
I know.
I either actually have to do all the shit that I was planning on doing, or I'd leave on tour again.
Yeah, that's sort of the, you know, like Tatiana, bless her heart, she'll be trying to tell me about some things that need to be done around outside, and I'm like, just call somebody, you know, because it's like, you know, all the other shit you have to, you know, you're stressed about, and then you get this other thing, this whole other realm piled on it, and it's kind of like I can't handle it, you know.
Yeah.
Mentally, you just go freak out. So
it's a funny thing in this business, like, and I think that country, the world of country, at least the touring side of it, is maybe structured a little bit different than like rock and roll world, where it's less attached to album cycles. You know,
right.
I mean, like where we sort of tour around an album, but it seems like you guys tour like you're
constantly,
touring constantly. Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. But that is a funny thing, like that sort of like. You know, when you do this for a long time, you get into that habit of like there's always that thing on the horizon that you're racing towards, and then but you never really get to it.
It's just like,
you know, if you're lucky,
pushing that rock up the hill,
right,
watching it roll down the other side, go around the corner and push it up there again.
Yeah. Do you live here now? This is home for you nowadays?
Yeah, I just moved. I lived like an hour and a half outside of town, out in the country for a while, but when my wife's from Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, really?
So when she got pregnant.
The guy playing bass with me right now is from Melbourne.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love Melbourne.
Oh, it's so
fantastic
awesome.
City.
Yeah. Absolutely. Fantastic country down there.
Oh, I freaking love it all.
Do you tour down there much?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool.
We go there quite a bit.
Australia has like its own country music scene.
We do very well over there. They're I mean, some of the, you guys have been. It's like literally some of the most amazing music fans there are. They just, you know, you go over there and they know every word to every song you ever put out.
Yeah.
You know, it's freaking amazing. I love it. We'll go back, I think, in April. We'll go back and we do probably 5 or 6 shows around there. And just kind of hit every corner of it, you know.
Yeah, nice.
But I love it. But so when she got pregnant with our little boy, it was like I had her so far out in the country, it was like, we got to get you in close to people because we meet on right. tour and her out there.
She need help.
Yeah.
I know. We're lucky that my wife's parents don't live too far away. I mean, it's, you know, an hour and a half away or whatever, but it's close. Like, my mom's hours and hours. You know, my mom's a plane ride away. So that was like, you know, having them around in those early years. I got three boys and they're all a little bit older now.
Yeah.
You know,
it's tough. It's hard. With her, not, you know, her mom stayed for like, I don't know, 6 weeks or something like that, for the first month. But then they're gone, and it's like, what now?
You know?
So she's really had to step up, and she has. I'm pretty proud of her.
So that's your first child?
I have one little boy named Wes that lives out in L.A. from my first marriage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's seven.
Were you living out in L.A.? Was there a time when you were living out there?
No, I never lived out there. I spent a lot of time out there, but... Right. No, her two sisters lived out there.
So, okay.
And her parents just moved out there, so she'd been wanting to move out there forever.
Right.
So she went.
And where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Mississippi, between Jackson and Meridian, Mississippi.
Okay. So not like super duper far away from here.
No, like 6-5 hours, something
right,
like that.
Right. For some reason, I thought you were like a Texas dude.
But no, maybe Mississippi.
That's just because I saw you in Austin. I'm guessing I'd put that association on you.
Not much different.
Let's talk about your latest record.
Right.
I read a good quote of yours where you said something to the effect of, like, you know, you changed up how you approach, you know, to making this latest record, because you said something about, like, feeling like you were singing karaoke or something on tour, and went back to a more sort of stripped down, you know, three-piece approach or something to making this new one.
Yeah, we, to just back up a little bit, I was doing these, you know, big tours and, you know, direct support for a lot of the big country guys and who are great friends of mine. But I got in this sort of place where I felt like I was trying to keep up with them on the production side, you know, like we had all the freaking bells and whistles and screens
and the lasers and the,
yeah,
the whole deal.
And then we were running some tracks and all that shit. And I was like, and one day I went out there, and I'll never forget it. I remember I was singing a song that I didn't like. I didn't give a shit about it. And I walked off the stage, and I called, my manager was over there on the side. I said, I just can't, I hate this. I said, this ain't what I came here to do. And I said, take all those lights and all that stuff and put it on that truck that we have, and take that stuff and that truck back, you know. And and I was like, if we're gonna make music, we're gonna make music, and it's not gonna be any of this other crap, you know. And it led to just a lot of different things creatively for me. Just I just sort of was, it in a way, country music, you know, modern radio country, just kind of went to a place that I couldn't go, I mean, I could,
right,
you know, if that's what I wanted to do,
sure,
but just my soul wouldn't let me, you know. It was just like, okay, this is too far down, but this is far down this road as I can go, you know?
Like, before you made your, I'm wondering how that was received by your label. Like, did you have that conversation before you went in to make the record? Did you turn the record in and go, like, I'm doing something a little different this time?
Actually, what I did was I started recording and just started paying for it myself, because I was quite sure they were going to drop me.
You know, really?
I was just, I just kind of sort of hid the fact that I was recording for a while. And then finally they kind of caught wind that I was doing something and wanted to come over and listen. So, and I was over, you know, my buddy Gaddis, Keith Gaddis.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'd been working for probably 3-4 months, you know, just messing around. And it never really was that we were starting to make a record. It was just like, let's just go explore sounds and songs and stuff like that.
Write some tunes.
Yeah, and just went down that road, and they came over and said, we love it, just keep doing what you're doing, go for it. And they gave me my money back, and let's keep going.
I mean, that must have felt like validating to you, right?
It was a big, you know, sort of sigh of relief that I could just kind of let out and go, okay, some support, you know?
Right.
And I honestly, because my record label is so far in the center lane, you know, this is kind of what they do, you know, is, you know, we make that for that. We make red cars, yellow cars, green cars, but they're all the same car. You know? right. And that's nothing against them. That's just how their business model was set up, you know, from the beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, it was just, you know, I signed with them during a time that, you know, it was just like, I didn't have nothing going on. You know, it was like I'd had a couple of hits, you know, I'd had songwriter stuff, and then I'd had a couple of hits on some other labels and all, but I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to, okay, yeah, they wanted to sign me to a deal, and I was like, okay, let's go, you know, and so it just got to the point where I just wanted to do what I do, you know, and not, you know, and have anybody sort of push me into recording stuff I really didn't care about. You know?
I mean, what does it take to sort of, I understand how you just went and kind of did it yourself, mm-hmm. and then they came around to it. But generally, like in mainstream country music, how do artists sort of wrest that creative control thing, you know, from the, how does that balance of power shift? Is it just like, well, fuck, I got a few hit records now, so we're going to renegotiate my contract and I'm going to get to work with who I want the way I want, you know what I mean? Like, what is that?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's all good.
Honestly, I don't know that how many of the guys even know the difference, or how many quote unquote artists are even questioning it. Or even know anything about, you know, in, know the other side of their creativity other than this sounds like a hit song.
Right.
You know. And
it's interesting though nowadays, and like a lot of the people that you collaborated with on your latest record, you know, like Brothers Osborne or mm-hmm. Jaron from Cadillac 3, it does seem like there is this thing happening in the mainstream country music. I mean, I don't follow like charts and radio airplay, so I don't know where it's all at in comparison to, say, like the more sort of like, you know, pop stuff. But like, it does seem like there are people carving out something that's a bit left of center, you know?
Yeah, there are some, like those guys definitely would definitely fit in that left of center category.
Yeah.
I think I'd identify with those type people more, you know, that want to explore sounds and want to explore, you know, something other than just this is going to make me some money, you know.
Right.
And I mean, I for me, that's the case too. Yeah, I just wasn't, you know, it can't be, I can't just go do it just so, because I know I can have a number one hit, you know. It's like, gotta, you know, if there's no soul in it to me, then I can't sleep.
Right.
You know? And so there is a sort of a bubble of those kind of artists that live in, and kind of came up in Nashville. There is a huge ground swelling here of people that are demanding that they get to do what they do.
Right.
You know, and
I mean, I guess Chris Stapleton would be the sort of the extreme example of that.
Of
you
course.
Know what I mean? A guy that, like, you know, very much came up through the sort of the music row,
the
songwriter side of it, right? And then makes records that don't sound like, you know, what the country that you hear on the radio or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, I was here when Chris first moved here, and we all kind of wrote around the same publishing houses and all that.
Yeah.
But he was just so, so freaking good that it was like, eventually it was just like the whole town was like, you know, what the fuck are y'all thinking? You know, we've got one guy here that can just fucking kill.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And so it was like, you know, I think that almost everybody was so far in his corner, you know, because it was one of those things where, you know, he was the guy that could kick a lot of doors open for everybody if he got a shot,
and has. Yeah.
You know, and it's been really interesting to watch, you know. I'm a huge fan, it's been really great.
And how did like your fan base respond to, you know, because this is something I'm really kind of fascinated by. I always wonder the stuff, the nuance in production that people who do this for a living think about and, you know, focus on and everything. You know, like, do you think casual music fans even hear the difference between a more sort of organic sounding record and something with like a lot of bells and whistles and modern production?
I mean, yeah, I think they probably do.
Maybe on some like subconscious level or something. I just think about like, I always bounce like music off my wife, who has none of the baggage with listening to music that I have. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I'm an opinionated musician. You know,
I get it. Yeah.
You know, I've been doing it for a long time. But like, it's, and it's funny. So I always wonder about that. Like, I wonder how much people hear, you know, what we're talking about.
I think it's sort of like kids, you know, like, you know, it's like children. It either resonates with them or it doesn't. I don't know if they're obviously their ears are tuned to a certain sound. That's why you know, like country radio is programmed the way it is. It goes and it hits these phases and everything sounds like this, you know, and everybody does that because that's what the ears are tuned to.
Sure.
But it's always been like, for me, it's always been my dream, and I guess the dream of most artists is to be able to, you know, be able to do what it is that resonates with you and still find, you know, that audience.
Yeah.
And so I think that most of my fans have they do love what I'm doing, you know, and it's and I think that a lot of my fans sort of expect me to kind of go left and right a little bit, you know. Right. I'm not one of those people that can continue to, you know, to make, you know,
make the same song over and over again.
No, it's just not in me. I like to explore.
Yeah.
And if you listen to my different albums I put out over the years, they're different things from each other, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's just part of my nature. I get bored, man. I have to go see what, you know. But I do think that probably, I think that, you know, something happened about the time I was like about to turn 40, and I'm 43 now, that was just like, I don't know, it was just one of those things where I sort of, I don't know if it was a maturity thing or what it was, or just fed up with the bullshit, that I just wanted to, you know, win, lose, or draw, go at least be happy creatively.
Sure.
And that's the most important thing to me.
Yeah. Know? Can you talk about like the different collaborations that you did on this record? So I know you wrote with, or I don't know if they guested, or you just wrote with like I said, the Brothers Osborne, Jane Johns, Lucy Silva, some of those folks. Like, are those all folks that you already were friendly with and maybe worked with? And had you written with those folks before?
I had. We'd all see each other out on different tours together and just become friends, you know, and written, you know, just written with a lot of those guys for several years. And our buddy Kendall, we've been writing for a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just sort of a natural progression to kind of collaborate and sort of play. Like, you know, the brothers came over and played on a song called New Buzz that me and Gaddis wrote and sang on it, and then John and I wrote a song, What Leaving Looks Like, on the album. And so it was, you know how it is whenever you write something with somebody that you fucking love and you don't want to let go of that creative energy that person brings around. So naturally, come to the studio, let's keep going, you know.
Come join in.
Yeah. And so it was more about just hanging out with people you love.
Yeah.
And just, you know, having fun, being creative.
Did Gaddis play on the record too?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's both Gaddis of you guys
produced
playing
it.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
He produced it and played on it.
Yeah, we both
and played. You played a lot of the guitar on it too, right? Yeah.
And that was part of one of the things that was really a catalyst for making this record was the fact that, you know, I played a lot of guitar on the Cadillac record, but for the two records after that, I don't even know if I played one or two songs on there. It was just that Nashville.
Right.
We're gonna bring the band in. We're gonna sing these songs. And I was just like, I fucking hate this.
Right. Interesting.
And it was just, this album was sort of, you know, it was, I wanted to play my guitar and do my, you know, make the songs feel like I want them to feel.
Right.
You know.
Like the way I wrote them.
In my head.
Right, yeah. That's interesting. So in those kind of sessions, are you singing the track live while, I mean, that's kind of the amazing thing about those really, those like classic sort of, you know, you hear about those Nashville recording sessions, all the fucking top session cats and everything. It's interesting that they're made like live.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That the music, that a recording style that's very slick is also like done live right in the room. Then. Yeah. You know?
Well, those guys are, and I love, one of the things I love about my favorite albums and all is Imperfection.
Right.
And you don't get that with those cats.
Right.
And I love them and they're freaking amazing.
Sure.
But it's perfect every time.
Right.
They wouldn't say that because they hear everything that they screw up.
Right. Sure.
But to us, we're like, I mean, they are. They're the cleanest, best in the world at creating that, you know, and they're fast and proficient and they know how to do that. And it is, and a lot of it has to do with the way, the difference in rock and roll budgets and country album budgets. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, at some, these record companies, they're like, we got to get this done quick and, you know, cheap and, so you're not
sitting around in the studio going, what does this Memory Man pedal sound like?
Exactly.
That's
that's a big part of the element of that, you know, and the producers that produce that kind of music know what they're going to get.
Yeah.
And they're used to working with X guys and they just, you know, that's the whole game.
Mm.
So it was a pretty big monkey wrench I threw in the building when I was like, but I was, prepared to, not have a record deal and all that. It wasn't, it wasn't probably the most financially sound move I ever made, but I don't give a shit. I'm touring all the time, and that's what takes care of me and my family. And it takes care of me mentally.
Like, you could just be like Jamie Johnson, just stop making records altogether.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to get him to get back at it. You know?
What the fuck is the deal with that? Why doesn't he make records, man?
He will. You know, he's starting to write again. Jamie's probably the closest thing I have to a brother. You know, we've been friends for a long time.
Right. Were you both writing together? Like,
When he and I moved here about the same time, he's from Montgomery, Alabama, and I'm straight across from Lake Mississippi. And it was just like, as soon as we met, we loved the same things, we loved the same music, and
same kind of life experience.
Both grew up poor as shit, and just trying to figure out how to make music for a living. And so we spent a lot of time together, and he's I can't wait for him to make an album. He's just waiting on what he wants to say, or having something to say.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I got to back him up at a gig last year at the Country Music Hall of Fame. It was like they had an Outlaws and Armadillos exhibit thing. They put together this whole concert thing, and it was, man, just to stand on stage and hear that guy sing, just go, wow, that's fucking powerful. Powerful shit.
It happened to me 18 years ago.
Right.
And he was just so far beyond any other voices that I'd heard around here. It was like, wow. That natural thing that just flowed out of that guy was like, wow. I love him, man. He's a genius, man.
Well, so what were you doing before you moved to Nashville? Before you were like a professional songwriter? Like, did you have bands and stuff coming up?
Yeah, I did. I obviously started my first band in like the eighth grade down there, like everybody does. And then I as soon as I got out of high school, I went to a little junior college there in Mississippi, and I started playing in this band with do you know who Chris Etheridge was? He was a bass player for the Burrito Brothers, and he played with Willie for a long time. Yeah, and he played on a lot of records. And
wow!
But he was one of the original Burrito Brothers, and he was from Meridian, And he and his brother, Joey Etheridge, and these old guys, they used to have this band, the Dirt Band. Mm. And not that one, but, you know. Right. But so we started a band, and I was probably 21 at the time. And I always played with guys that were 30 years older than me. Sure. It's just kind of a, because I didn't really identify with a lot of what was going on at the time for people my age, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
And
I imagine you must have learned a lot from those folks.
I did. Yeah, I really did. It was, you know, so I played in a band called The Trucks with those guys till I was probably 24. And then I started another band called 10 Pound Biscuit that was like a a Mississippi rock and roll kind of blues rock kind of band.
Yeah, yeah.
And
were you already writing songs in that in the, in those years?
I was always writing songs. You know,
really?
I just sits off.
Did
probably,
that just kind of go hand in hand with playing?
Yeah,
yeah.
It was just yeah. I think so. I mean, I guess it was. You know, I don't know. It was so, for some reason, a lot of times I couldn't find a whole lot of songs that I wanted to cover that felt like I felt. Mm-hmm. You know. Which I love everything. I love all the stuff that my heroes did. But sure. It was like, you know, I wanted to somehow be able to stamp it my way. You yeah. know? And
like, who were your heroes? Like, who were the folks that you were listening to? Like, who were your songwriting heroes?
Oh, definitely Willie's my biggest hero, right. You know, of all time.
Sure.
He was my dad's biggest hero, too, you know.
Your dad was a musician, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He was. And so he would... You know, he was always playing Willie songs around the house, and he had a little gut string. He'd always, but he was also, you know, he played, you know, he played on a lot of demos, like at Malico and stuff like that, and Jackson. He was a Hammond player and piano player.
Wow.
But he was also a really great guitar player and singer, you know.
Yeah.
So I just sort of came up, you know, how it really first started for me was watching my dad. I remember distinctly sort of, going with him and watching him rehearse with his band.
Mm.
And somehow I was probably 5 years old, I was able to put together that all these different people were making different sounds, and they were coming out of these speakers as one sound. And right. It blew my mind. I was like, oh yeah,
that's how they do that.
That's how they
thing.
Yeah. And it's so I was done, you right. know, just as a kid that early.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, just played in several bands, and then I didn't move here till I was I moved to Nashville when I was 26, and I had the band 10 Pound Biscuit, I guess, for 2 or 3 years or something like that.
Yeah.
And I moved here. Everybody, it just seemed like nobody was ever as serious about it as me.
Mm.
You know, and I was the guy going with the taking a truckload of gear to every gig. It, you know, when at noon every time we'd have to go play and set up my own PA, and
right.
you know, I was the guy that was serious about it.
Sure.
And then when it came down to, you know, let's go try to make a go of it, everybody was, I'm just gonna keep my job, and, you know, and I was like, I'm never gonna, this is my job, you
right,
know,
right,
this is what I'm gonna do, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
So I've always been one of those that was, you know, it gonna figure out, you know, feast or famine, I'm gonna play music because that's where I feel at home, you know.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I mean, it's just what I love to do.
It's an interesting thing that you just touched on, like, it's, you know, you not only have to be able to kind of do it, play your guitar, play your instrument, whatever it is, sing, you have to be willing to sleep on the couches and rough it, and
yeah,
you
always
know, be up till 4 a.m. and still get to work at 8, and all, you know, all that shit that you have to do to get into it. I think about my own, you know, teenage years, and a lot of, you know, I came from a place that at a time when there's just a lot of people, it seemed like everybody had a band, but
yeah.
not a whole lot of those folks wanted to go after it that way.
Yeah, I know. It was just something that was sort of innately in me, and, yeah. and I, you know, I always talk, I played this, used to have a house gig at a place called the Shed House, and it was in Meridian, and I slept on the pool table there almost every Friday night, you know. Uh-huh. I always called it my paper towel pillow on a pool table bed.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I did.
So how did you then go from that to wind up? So you moved to Nashville when you're like around 26. But how did you wind up? I assume at that point you were you were trying to make it as an artist, a band guy, solo artist, whatever. How did you wind up on Music Row in the songwriting world?
Derek George, who produced not this past album, the two albums before. He's from Philadelphia, Mississippi, and he was writing for a company called Windswept that Kendall was writing for. Okay. And so this is several years ago, and so we knew each other, and he said, you know, he had some budget to go mess with Steve Marklin, who is a publisher here, told Derek if he ever found an artist or anything and wanted to, you know, start kind of messing around, to that he would back him on it. So I came here as soon as he opened the door and said that might be a possibility. I was in my car, you know?
I'll be there in 15 minutes.
Yeah, so I came up here, and he had introduced me to Steve Marklin and Cliff Aldrich, and they took a meeting with me, and I just brought my guitar in and played them some songs, and then I'd met this girl, Danette, that went to the same little junior college I did, and she was up here wanting to be a singer. So I had like $1,500 in my pocket to get here and try to find a place and all that, and so I got here. And about 3 or 4 days after I got here, I was hanging out, and I ran into this girl, and she said that she had a demo, that she had some friends that needed somebody to sing some demos for them. And she said, you'd be perfect for this. And I was like, okay, you know, and it sounded like I said, well, how much do I charge them? I don't know. And I asked somebody, I can't remember who it was, and they said, well, just charge them like $75. So I went over, sang this demo, made $75, and then the next week I had like 10 to do. You know, it was like, so I immediately, you know, I was like, oh, okay, I can make a living doing this in the meantime. So, and I had that meeting with Steve and Cliff at Windswept, and they decided to sign me to a publishing deal as a staff songwriter, because I went and played them a bunch of my songs that were terrible songs that I'd written back home, you know, and so
did you immediately sort of get thrown into that, you know, doing co-writes with people and you're working every day working on your songwriting?
Yeah.
How long did it take to till you started getting cuts?
Probably, let's see, probably 3 years.
Really?
Yeah, 3.5.
That's somewhere. Interesting. So they keep you on the payroll even if, like, for an extended amount of time, like even if you're not getting...
Yeah.
Cuts on people's records?
Well, it was only, you know, I did a deal with them. It was 20 grand for 12 songs a year.
Right.
And that means if I'd have written 12 solo.
Right. So it's really 36.
36,
right?
Yeah.
Right. Because it's a couple other people. Right.
But
right.
What it really was it's kind of like farm league recording industry. You know, it really, like, you know, a lot of my friends that are my favorite artists kind of came up through that rank.
Sure.
We all live together, you know.
And does the industry frown on that, or does the industry nurture that?
That's a nurture for sure.
Right. Yeah, so that's kind of the idea. We could get people writing songs, and then eventually we'll
create
see
these communities
gonna,
of people and see who and the cream rises, you know.
Right.
And so everybody sort of, you know, Nashville's very campy, you know. I mean, you kind of you kind of find your group of people that you mesh with sort of, you know. So we, you know, there's a great group of talented people.
Who was your group? Like, who are you riding with a lot in those years?
Kendall would have been one.
Okay.
Dallas Davidson, Jamie.
Right. Speaking of those two, tell me about the songwriting session for Honky Tonk Badonky Donk.
I don't even know if you
can call sure you're
that.
I'm you sure you're sick of fucking telling that story.
That turned into a stupid song. That was pretty much what that was. I mean, really, you know, that was our first, any of us, that was our first cut that we'd ever had.
Really?
Yeah, it was crazy.
Damn, that's a pretty good first cut. You know, that, I mean, you must have been like, I hit the fucking jackpot.
Oh, I'll never forget it. Not, you know, the story of how I spent all that money was pretty epic, too. In a week.
Really?
Pretty close.
Oh, no.
Yeah, well, we were crazy as hell in those days. You know, we just thought we'd conquered the world, you know, and we, you know, in our little group, we had, you know, it was like, and it, that, so the song, that song came, we were, our, we had a, our other buddy, Rob Hatch, is a songwriter buddy of ours, well, he was a bartender at the Wild Horse Saloon, and none of us had a dime, you know, so we'd go in there and he'd pour us free drinks, and so we're we're hanging out on the Wild Horse is set up like on multi levels, so you could look over and watch all the dancing going on, the line dancing stuff that was going on, and I think the Low Cash Cowboys or Low Cash or whatever, they were teaching line dance down there at the time. It was pretty funny, and so we were watching these girls dancing, and there was this girl. She had a, I mean, she's just a huge ass. You know, she was like, every time, she didn't know any of the steps, but if she moved, everybody had to go around, you know what I'm saying? and I just leaned over the rail, and I looked down there, and somehow that line popped in my head. So I pulled Jamie over to the side. I said, Jamie, y'all going to hate me and love me for this. And I told him, I said, that's a honky-tonk badonkadonk right there. So we went and we wrote it in about 30 minutes.
No shit.
And, well, we wrote most of it, and then we went to cut a demo over County Q, and Jamie had a demo session over there. And back in those days, everybody just sort of showed up at everybody's demo sessions because it turned into a party every time.
Right.
And so they were in there tracking it, and I realized it needed a bridge to it, and I took the chart and I jotted down the changes for the bridge, you know, and I said, well, just have the band play this. And Dallas and I went out and laid on the hood of somebody's old Dodge Diplomat or something like that out in the parking lot. And it was really pretty spring day. We laid out there and wrote the bridge to it and took the lyric back into Jamie so he could sing the demo.
Now, I know, like, nobody ever really knows when they have just recorded a massive earth-shattering hit, but like, did you have the sense when that was done where you're like, oh shit, I think we're onto something here?
We all knew,
right?
It was just so far left of everything, you know, and just so fucking stupid that it was like, they're gonna love this,
right? You know? I mean, it fucking worked.
It was a really incredibly experienced for us.
What's the life of a song that way? So you do record the demo, and then how does it get sent out? Like, was there like a feeding frenzy of artists like going like, no, I want that song, no, hold it for me, hold, no, I got, you know, like,
there was a few people that were that had it on hold, and then Trace Adkins heard it, and I think Tracy Bird had it on hold, and Brett Jones was a guy that was Dallas's publisher at the time, knew that Trace wanted to cut it. Well, he was old friends with Tracy Bird, and he said, man, these guys have never had a cut, they've been busting their ass, and you've had it on hold for a while, and they, you know, we all need something to happen for these guys. And he let it go and let Trace cut it, and it was just, and there it was. It was like, you know, it was pretty it was pretty wild. I mean,
well, okay, so fast forward to now, like, having gone through all, you know, that experience of being a writer on Music Row, I mean, how does your writing differ, your process of writing a song differ now, or does it, like, do you still just get together with somebody you're comfortable writing with and flesh it out, or is it a different thing?
It's quite different. I think that, you know, those years spent doing that sort of have, you know, molded sort of the way I see songs in a format, kind of how I see, you know, the way they line out. And I have to talk myself out of that sometimes, you know, because it's kind of like, you know, you just come up doing that, and that's how you, here's the way a song goes, you know?
Yeah. So what is it for you now? Like, what do you do
so now?
So now
it's more for me, you know, mostly I write late at night, you know, midnight till 3 or 4 in the morning.
Really?
And I just always have had a sort of a space that I go to in my house or somewhere. I just built a studio here in town at the house. But I usually just go there and smoke a bunch of weed and wait.
Pen.
Yeah.
Paper.
Pen. Weed. Pen.
right.
Pipe.
Right.
Paper.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's so for me, mostly now I'll write enough of the song till I get tired of it. And so that I can make sure that it feels like I want it to feel, and that headed the direction that, you know, that I feel like I want it to go, you know.
Right.
And then I'll get several of those going and then go hang out with my buddies and finish them, you know.
Right. And is that kind of like almost like the rewrite edit process?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, for me it is, because it's like a, not, it's not, you know, I could write them myself, but I enjoy the camaraderie so much of hanging out with my boys, and
it always goes somewhere you don't expect it.
And they're all so talented that, you know, I trust them to bring this other little piece of what they have into it to make it better.
Yeah.
And I do tend to, you know, hold on tight to them, because it's like, you know, these you know, it's hard to let go. And but then if you're with the right people, they always surprise me with what special things they bring to the song.
For sure.
Yeah.
How did you wind up transitioning out of the music row world into being a solo artist performer?
You know, it was, I guess, after we all had that hit with Badonkadonk, it was sort of, you know, we were all out and had our own bands, you know. Right. Dallas was just going to be a songwriter, but like for Jamie and I, you know, we were always sort of touring with our bands together. We'd just go do whatever, you know, and it just natural progression, you know.
You guys were always touring even like before you were making records?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, we always booked our own, booked gigs together, and you know, we'd all pile on one bus or a van, and everybody'd go. Or if we couldn't afford it, we'd just take one band,
right,
and kind of go tag team it.
Were you kind of developing a fan base already, even before you were making records? That's amazing.
Yeah. It was, you know, because for me, it was, you know, the love of playing music live is that's where it's at for me.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, I think that sometimes, for a long time, I think the songwriting thing was just so I'd have something to play live, right. You know, because I just love it. And so, yeah, we all had been writing songs for us. So we'd always have a lot of songs that we would just write to, let's go, okay, here we fulfill our deal.
Sure.
You know, make sure we get our next 20 grand next year, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's always those songs that we kind of held back that we knew were for us for that one day that we got an actual chance to go make a record.
No shit.
So it was
did any of those songs wind up being hits for you? Like, were any of those songs the ones that like helped put you on the map as an artist?
Yeah, the second single I ever had out was a song called Boots On, and it was one of those that I'd written probably 4 years before I had a record deal that a lot of people wanted to cut. And I was just like, no, I'm gonna hang on to that one. And it was, I think it ended up like number 2 or 3, you know. It was a hit.
Yeah.
And but it was one of those songs, you know, just for an example of one that, you know, I didn't want to let go of, you know, because it was one of those that was more uniquely me than I could, you know, like, I'm trying to write this for such and such.
Sure. What's the rest of your year looking like now? Like, when did your latest record come out?
In January. Yeah.
So are you beginning to like get the pangs for the next recording, you know?
Yeah, I am.
You don't have to hide it from your label this time?
No, we're, you know, it's been, you know, we moved from out in the country, and so I sold all my tractor and boats and, you know, like bass boat and all that stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And four-wheelers and stuff. I didn't have anywhere to put them in town. So I took all that and just cash grabbed and built me a proper studio that I can track in.
Nice.
And,
at and, your house?
Mm-hmm.
God,
so great. It's just now I fired my console up last week for the first time.
Wow.
You know, and just now I'm trying to get everything in place to start getting my band in, because I want to record with my band a lot.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and
yeah.
And start searching for what the next one's going to be, you know.
Yeah.
So I am starting to I've been bitching at the wiring guy. I'm like, you got to finish, because I'm ready to get in here and start
right.
messing around.
Yeah
but that, and we're going to do a I'm finishing up like festival season in the next few weeks, and then I'm going to start the Magnolia tour, just like supporting this album. More like a, I don't know, big clubs and theaters. And,
yeah, cool.
And Paul Coffin's going to come out and do that
tour.
Oh,
great.
So we're going to have a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a new record either coming out, or I know a couple songs already up out of it.
It's a great album. Room 41.
Yeah.
That's a great album.
Yeah.
So we're just going, you know, he and I have been writing some songs together. And
really?
We've kind of explored the thought of doing sort of a duo record kind of thing.
That would be great.
Just for the fun of it. Because we started writing, and we both started singing. As we were writing, we started singing the song together, and this sound came out that was like, what the hell is this, you know? But it was like, we looked at each other, was like, oh my god, what is that? And it was something that, you know, we both really enjoyed. So we're gonna try to write a bunch when we do this tour. That was kind of part of the deal. Let's do this tour together so we can write a bunch of songs and see what happens.
Set up the Pro Tools rig in the back lounge and get at it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fucking great, man.
It'll be fun.
Congrats. That's very cool.
I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Well, dude, thank you for fucking busting ass to get over here right when you got home, man. I really appreciate it.
I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
Yeah.
I'm glad it finally worked out.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Fire out in L.A. Hell,
I'm just glad nobody knew my name.
Oh, yeah, that was Randy Houser on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I will post some links so you can check out where he's at. I'm sure he's out on the road somewhere, hitting it hard as always. And that's it for this week. We'll be back in a couple weeks, assuming the Santa Ana winds don't burn my house down. Let's fingers crossed. And I don't know which episode I'll be posting next. I got a lot of great interviews in the can. Tune in 2 weeks. We'll see you then, kids. Adios, amigos!